Welcome to episode 74. Thank you for coming back as we wrap up my assignment at the National Defense University and also my Air Force career. By making the decision to control my own destiny with the Air Force, by dropping my papers to retire, it took me out of any potential selection for promotion in resident school or assignments, and it did seem like the right one. 5 years at NDU provided me with some wonderful experiences, and our team moved the university forward, better aligning it with other graduate schools in the United States and around the world, to be fair. With my enlisted career, I will have 28 years of service. My plan to flip condos was hopefully to eliminate a mortgage payment, and my retirement would be hopefully sufficient. At the time, I thought back to the reason I joined the Air Force in the first place. Remember that it was my grandfather, in large measure, who served in the United States Marine Corps in his very proud service and his identity as a Marine. And then also, both of his sons served in Vietnam as United States Marines as well. And that was important to my own decision to serve. The plan was to serve for 4 years and then figure out what was next. Despite the physical attack shortly after arriving at my first base and the critical decision at that time to stay, those 4 years turned into 28, and so it was time. I had many experiences in the first 25% of my career in the enlisted force, and then, over the course of my officer career, almost 40% was spent outside my career field, 37% on a headquarters staff to include the air staff at the Pentagon, and that only left 3 relatively short assignments at base level. It was a varied experience and also laid a solid foundation for after my career, or so I thought. With my education, experience at UT, making full professor at UMUC, and a leadership position at NDU, I felt that there was a very solid foundation for moving into a possible career in higher education, and frankly, if I really thought about still working. I was wrapping up my career at NDU, something very curious happened. I started out processing, which included most requirements at the closest Air Force base, which was Bowling Air Force Base in Southeast DC. And there is a personnel office at NDU with each of the services represented, and their responsibility is also to finalize the retirement process for military members. As time was getting closer, I also knew my boss was processing a final decoration or medal for my service. When you retire from the Air Force, you typically get a retirement certificate, a certificate from the President of the United States, and depending on timing, other elements that document your military service. Of course, you also get a final DD Form 214, which is your official document for your service that enables you to get benefits outside of the military. Well, none of that was happening. I questioned what was going on and wasn't really getting a satisfactory answer. This is a very typical process, and it wasn't like there weren't other officers who retired from NDU, and so they already knew the process. Alas, there was no processing of these very pro forma documents. So I went to the chief of staff to try to get an answer to what was going on. Once General Wilson, the university president, got word that the process seemed out of sorts, she not only got involved, she hosted a retirement ceremony and reception in her office. A lot of action started moving very quickly, and I'm not sure if it was an innocent oversight or if there was a more nefarious issue. I did feel it was simply unfair and was grateful that General Wilson did step in. I was awarded the Defense Meritorious Service Medal after the request for the Legion of Merit was disapproved since I wasn't a full colonel. It was a very nice ceremony, and I had been to many retirement ceremonies in my career, as you can imagine. And the service member would say, "Every day was amazing," or something to that effect. I said, "On the whole, it was a very rewarding career, and while not every day was sunshine, most were." I acknowledged the many mentors and supervisors who gave me opportunities and, frankly, had my back when maybe I didn't quite deserve it. I had a lot of leave on the books because my time as a squadron commander, you can accumulate extra leave. And so I was on terminal leave for quite a while ahead of my official retirement. And that allowed me to take care of working through the process with the VA. As I experienced the daunting process of applying for VA benefits, I'm sharing that process so that others who are entitled to disability benefits can both get a sense of how to navigate the process as well as understand how the process works. While I'm doing this, I'm at the same time looking at what opportunities might be out there. I wasn't necessarily planning to work after retirement, yet it certainly didn't hurt to see what was out there. My first thought was in higher education, and there were certainly plenty of colleges and universities in the DC area. Plus, I already was teaching at two of them as an adjunct professor. There wasn't anything at the time that I was really that interested in, and I really wasn't in a hurry anyway. So I also looked at what options there were in the federal government. That was, in my mind, the last area of interest, and I quickly learned that there was a new law, or relatively new law, that required all federal agencies to have a chief learning officer. Further, it required that this new position be a direct report to the agency head, and that meant most of the postings were for a senior executive service level employee. Well, now, this did seem interesting, and so I started to apply for some of the positions that were posted. For my listeners who have a U.S. Department of Defense background, you know that I couldn't realistically apply for any of the positions that were within the scope of DOD. Why? Within DOD, there is a general link to federal civilian jobs that have equivalency to military rank. Generally, an O6 is about the same as a GM-15, an O5, which I was, a GM-14, and senior executives are aligned to be equivalent to general or flag officers. So regardless of the experience of the individual, DOD agencies would equate that a retired O5 couldn't possibly apply for an SES position. However, HR offices in non-DOD agencies look at experiences to evaluate the appropriateness of the position posted. You may recall that last week I said that it is my recommendation that people should apply for a new job that you're about 80-85% qualified for. In part, that allows for career growth and also adjusts for potential for promotion to a higher level position. The civilian hiring process is a slow one, and eventually I had some interviews at various agencies. Having not applied for a job, well, almost ever, those first interviews were a bit rocky. There is, however, a silver lining. Since I was applying for chief learning officers in various agencies, the questions were becoming somewhat similar, which makes sense, and with each interview, I was gaining experience both with the interview process as well as the genre of similar positions. And while I still practiced for the interviews, there were some similarities with each of them. Some of the positions were for a CLO at the department level, like Health and Human Services, or HHS, and some were at agency levels like Citizen and Immigration Services, or CIS, that's within the Department of Homeland Security. About 75% of the positions were SES positions, and the other 25% were GM-15s. Now, I had a very good friend who told me a long time ago that when you're applying for a new position, and this was more in the military, but obviously applicable outside as well, picture yourself and that position. In other words, during the day, think of what you'd be doing if you were X, Y, or Z. This exercise does a couple of things. First, it's great for your affirmations, and so you can picture yourself in this position. And the second one is, remember that applying for a position is a two-way street. Maybe as you picture yourself in this position, it's not one that you want to do. And when you're retired, that's a pretty critical factor. There was a political appointee who worked at CIS and whose husband had a relationship with NDU. And so that was one that I was encouraged to apply for. I also was most interested in two others. One was at HHS, and one was at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or the FDIC, the federal agency that insures your money in financial institutions. The process is a long one. Not only are there HR processes, there is an interview process that varied by agency, and there was an approval process that required top approval due to the SES positions are limited by agency. At the same time, I'm in the process of seeking what benefits I'm entitled to within the Department of Veterans Affairs, or the VA. It's a completely different process from DOD, and it is unlike anything that certainly I've experienced. At one of the out-processing briefings, there was a lot of information about how the process works. One of the speakers was a representative from the DAV, or the Disabled American Veterans, and they offered to go through your medical records and identify what kind of conditions might qualify. Now, these folks that do this have a lot of experience, as they've done it for many veterans for decades. So, sure, go ahead. And they were very fast. They're flipping through the record and make a list of what they see. Now, if you're wondering why the DAV, a non-governmental organization, is there to assist those retiring or leaving the service, it's because the VA process is not the easiest to move through. It is highly recommended that when you're seeking VA benefits, that you use a Veterans Service Organization, or VSO. A VSO cannot charge a veteran for their services. In fact, no legal office or agency can charge a veteran for their services. And truly, it is to assist the veteran. And there are several VSOs. And in hindsight, the DAV was perfect for me. VA benefits are adjudicated at a regional VA office. Mine is in Roanoke, Virginia, which is in the central part of the state. Several VSOs have offices at or near a regional office, and the DAV is one of the more prominent ones. Their office is almost always in the same building, and in this case, was a floor below the VA review office. You sign up to have the VSO represent you with the VA, and it's a huge benefit. Imagine that instead of traveling to the central VA office, they're right there working on your behalf, and so that's what happened in my case. There is a very important fact about VA benefits, and it's not quite as arbitrary as you might think. And while anyone can evaluate something a bit different, in the case of the VA, the ratings for every possible medical condition is clearly outlined, and it's a law. This helps to ensure that there is some consistency in the evaluation of the veterans. And there's two really maybe odd but unique factors to the law. It says that a rating for a veteran cannot be affected by the veteran's age or their demeanor. And there's one more little hitch. If you have more than one rated medical condition, and that's generally likely, they will also have different ratings. The ratings can be 0 to 100%. A rating of 0 means that you don't get any compensation. However, you can be seen at a VA hospital or clinic at no charge for that condition. For veterans at the 50% rating or 100% rating, there are benefits unique to having that level of disability rating. And this is where the hitch comes in. If you have two items, one at 30% and one at 10%, your rating isn't 40%. What you say? Well, they use a formula to get a combined rating. In the example here, 40% becomes 37%. And there is a combined ratings chart that the VA uses and helps to demystify the whole process. So there are charts that help people figure out what is the rating and how is it computed. Are you confused yet? Good, because it is confusing. Once you get the letter from the VA with the rating evaluation, you have the option to contest it. And this is where your VSO comes into play again. As I mentioned, the ratings language is in law, so it's not too difficult to determine if there's an error. And I had one in my case. I followed the instructions to contest the rating. I didn't send it to the DAV because I figured that they were out of the picture. When I got the letter back from the VA confirming receipt of my claim, it was actually addressed to the DAV. So once you have a VSO in your corner, they're in your corner forever. Once the VA determines that there's a condition that might be eligible, you attend an evaluation by a VA contracted medical provider. The DOD record is a basis, but it cannot be used, and the VA doctor is the one that carries the most weight. Since one of my conditions was PTSD, I'll say right up front that this process is very challenging. It's conducted by a professional, of course, and go into detail as to the symptoms, the causes, and an evaluation of where you are. Since throughout my life, I had only consulted with chaplains at various bases to help me navigate what I was experiencing, having a mental health professional probe that was indeed difficult. And while I won't go into too much detail, what I will note here is that I learned more about myself and what I was dealing with than I ever have in my life. So, of course, they can't give recommendations on the next steps since they're really only there to evaluate you and not to treat you. I learned that from the instances that when I was in grade school to each traumatic situation since did build on each other. And while some were locked away and kept peeking out along the way, I also learned, most importantly, that while many veterans have PTSD from returning from war or conflict, mine was based on life events over a long period of time. I can't count how often through the course of my life that I wondered what my life would have been like without some of the trauma. Then I realized that I'm not the only person that has experienced bad things in my life. I just need to figure out how to keep dusting myself off and moving forward. In the next episode or so, I'll continue the process to help understand what it's like to go through it. Last week, I promised I'd share that last condo story that I had flipped, and so it's how I will end this episode. I had a fair amount of success so far, and the real estate boom was strong, while at the same time, as the song goes, you have to know when to hold them and know when to walk away. For those who know my self-taught prowess in the stock market, it's a sense, and I thought that the boom was coming to an end. Little did I know that it was coming sooner than later. The last condo I bought was in D.C., and it was a cool building with a very small unit. I chose not to buy parking with the condo because it was fairly close to a metro stop, although it was, as they say, steps away, meaning it was close but not super close. And there was an odd feature. The bathroom had a long entrance, and that wastes a lot of square footage, especially for a small one-bedroom apartment. The dining area was very small. Oh, okay, it was tiny. I listed it as I had in the past, and it wasn't getting very many lookers. I would often bike to the city for showings and did a couple of open houses. No takers. It was coming up on 4 weeks, and I was getting a little anxious because this is the longest I had ever held a property so far. In my mind, I was also thinking that I needed to hire an attorney to help close the deal, so I also got a lawyer lined up once I had a buyer. Once that got locked down, I still had no buyer. And now I'm coming up on 6 weeks, and my mortgage would be due in just two more. Several possible buyers were disappointed that there was no parking space. Well, it was too late for that. There was a parking garage diagonally across the street. And when I say diagonally, because of its location in the city, it was actually crossing three diagonal streets to the parking garage. So it wasn't like right across the street. I signed a contract to pay for 1 year of parking for the new owner of the condo, effective for a date in the future. That next week, I sold the condo. I was so lucky. It was literally at the peak of the market. And by the time the sale settled, it was definitely worth less than the selling price. There was another plus with my evil plan. Our tax code classifies the selling of these condos as a short-term capital gain since you own the asset for less than a year. Okay, how about just a few weeks? When the tech bubble burst in the 1990s, I had a substantial capital carryover loss. And when you have a carryover capital loss, you can only deduct $3,000 a year. It would take forever. The sales of these condos counted against those losses I was carrying over. So up to that carryover, it was tax-free, essentially. And I had one more condo to sell, my current residence. And since the market was cooling, I was getting a little nervous about that as well. The new condo was still delayed, and alas, that meant I wasn't going to be able to sell the condo for what I had planned. Well, we'll see how that goes next week. I hope that this episode, and in part the next couple of episodes, will help other veterans navigate through the labyrinth of the VA. I've done it more than once to include what you'll learn about when I had to go to a higher level when the DA did something that was actually prohibited by law. I've helped many veterans along the way with tips on moving through the process. As a heads up, starting today, I'm actually going to be out of town for a couple of days, so next week's episode might be a little shorter. Oh, I forgot. The little news on the Kona front, the calendar that she won the cover for is out, and she did a nice job posing for that. And we're going to be having her official portrait being painted, and I'll share that when it comes along in two more weeks. So anyway, have a great week, and thank you for coming back. I really appreciate it.